This interview is being conducted on November 23rd, 2013 with Mr. John Jacobs at the Indian Prairie Library in Darien, Illinois. My name is Deb Barrett. Mr. Jacobs was born on November 12th, 1932 in Chicago, Illinois. He is a retired manager for a food machinery company and learned of the Veterans History Project through the library newsletter. Mr. Jacobs has kindly consented to be interviewed for this project. Here is his story. So, John, where were you living just before you went into the service? What was your life like just before you
Well, I'm going to say that I went into the service when I matriculated at the University of Illinois at age 18. Because it was required that you go into ROTC. All males had to take ROTC training, at least for the first 2 years, in land-grant colleges.
Oh, okay.
So I took that first 2 years because it was required of me, just like physical education was required.
It was 1950? And
that was 1950. And because selective service was still being used for military manning, it was a matter of stay in college or get drafted. So my first 2 years was, you know, roses. I was exempt because I was in the ROTC. Then in my sophomore year, it was decided by the powers that be in government, whoever they are, that if you're going through the second 2 years of ROTC, advanced ROTC, you would still be exempt and as a matter of fact, that would enable you to become commissioned at the, I'm one step out. I've gotten my head confused between high school and college.
Okay.
No, that's right. Advanced ROTC enabled you to become commissioned at the end of your bachelor's education, which I was. And in the senior year, the prerequisites became ever more strict because now the Korean War had been wound down and they didn't need the manpower they needed, they had prior needed. So they were making more stringent strictures. If you want to stay in the Air Force ROTC and be commissioned, you had better sign up for flight training. So I always wanted to fly anyhow. As a kid, I used to lie on the grass and watch these Piper Cubs land in places like nearby Midway and so forth. And back it when Piper Cubs landed in Midway. No, I'm talking about the 30s.
Right.
And so anyway,
let me back you up just a little bit. When you were in the ROTC in college,
mm-hmm.
was it organized by the branch? So was there an Air
yes.
Force ROTC?
Yes. Oh, I should back up to that one.
So
I hated standing in line.
Okay.
So as a freshman, just arrived on the campus, I had to sign up for a ROT service. I went to the armory where you did the sign up after
right.
signing up all my courses, and I saw a great gob of men, young men, in one corner of the armory, and a lesser gob over in the other corner, and in the third of the fourth corners, there was a little dinky line of people. And that was the Navy ROTC, so I went in there, the shortest line, and I'm not stupid. So I went over there, and they said to me, well, you have to have a congressional appointment for this because we pay you while you're in college. So I said, well, okay, well, what's the next shortest line? That's Air Force. So that's why I went into the Air Force ROTC.
Okay.
And all these sequential things brought me to the commitment to flight training once in the Air Force. Because why be a desk jockey if you could learn to fly? And that led me to deciding through flight training to go into single-engine jets. It was an option between multi-engine bombers or cargo planes, helicopters, or single-engine fighter jets. And being young jockey-type guy, I went for the fighter jets.
So you were in the ROTC all 4 years in college?
Yes.
In the Air Force ROTC. What did you major in?
I had a split major. It was actually, I was a Chicago kid in the School of Agriculture, which is paradoxical.
Yeah.
But I was a very mechanical kid. I had purchased Junker cars, like three or four of them, before I graduated from high school. I had two of them before I even had a driver's license, but I'd work on them in the garage and occupy my parents' grief, of, you know. So anyway, and I was very mechanical. I have two older brothers, both of whom were in World War II, and they were both engineers, okay, trained as engineers along the line, and I won't get into that. One in Navy, one Marines, and Marine Air Force, as a matter of fact, the ground type, right, personnel, enlisted men. He had enlisted because, like me, he rather than go into the Army, he went into the Marines in 1943. So the Air Force looked the best to me and all options that I could consider at that time.
I
missed the point. Okay. I was mechanical. They were engineers, but they were, from my limited experience with them, mind you, they're 7 and 8 years older than I, they looked like they didn't know how to fix a faucet. Now, what kind of engineers don't know how to fix? And I was completely at ease with wrenches and faucets and anything. I'd take clocks apart. So I saw myself as engineering candidate, but I'd be darned if I was going to go to an engineering school that admits them. So I found scholarship to the School of Agriculture, courtesy the Chicago Dairy Tech Society. Okay. And then another scholarship came along that enabled me to have all my expenses paid. I was a very bright student as a kid, if I must say so myself. I was double promoted twice, and I was actually only 17 when I got out of high school. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
So what did you think you were going to be when you graduated from college? What was your plan?
I wasn't absolutely sure. I liked the idea of the dairy industry and food industry per se, because I figured whether the economy goes up or down, people have to eat, and therefore somebody has to fix that food for the people, mm-hmm, to eat.
Right.
And I figured I was in a sense of stability since I was a Depression baby. Not that we thought Depression was hard times. We didn't know any better times. I was born,
right,
in 32.
Right.
So what's the problem with that?
You were born during a depression, so
we learned things at home that these kids these days can't possibly learn, because they have everything done for them and easy credit and maxing it out. And, you know, I don't have to go there with that story. But so that's stability of the industry,
right,
appealed to me.
Okay.
But when I got out of the service and decided which way I should go, my flying experience said, well, maybe I should go in the airlines. And I applied to three of the major airlines at the time, but two of the three responded. And by the time they responded, I said, this is the wrong time to go in the airlines. They're just going to convert, they hadn't done yet, to jets. And we had already proven the jets in the military, highly efficient, fast, carried big loads and so forth. And I knew that all these World War II pilots would flood the market, and I'd be at the bottom end of the totem pole, and I wouldn't be able to support my growing family.
Right.
We wound up having five children in all, but at that time of decision making, I had two already.
Okay.
See, so.
All right. So let's back up again. You were in college, and you said ROTC was mandatory.
Right.
For state universities.
Land-grant state universities. Those are schools that were given federal lands in order to provide the education for this growing population in the United States.
Okay.
And each of the major schools, like Michigan State, Penn State, Purdue, Illinois, Iowa, Wisconsin, they're all land-grant schools, and they all had ROTC organizations in them.
Okay.
So, some, all three. Some maybe just Army, some were Air Force.
Okay. So
to this day, Purdue has a very big Navy ROTC. Navy. In Indiana. Get that one? In fact, I went to the Navy ball of a young lady who graduated from the ROTC there, and is today a helicopter pilot in Afghanistan. No, somewhere in the Middle East.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So, your ROTC experience, what were your requirements, or what did you have to do while you were at Illinois?
Well, they have a, they had a prescribed curriculum. Everything was mandatory in each year, and the year progressed. And while I was in the advanced ROTC, the last 2 years of school, I was promoted to the executive officer of the organization. That was second in command. And there's some funny stories about that, but I won't go there.
Okay. But what did your ROTC involvement entail while you were there? I mean, did you, you had your regular classes?
Yeah, and once
some
a week.
Some were required, I know.
Right.
What did the ROTC require?
We learned the military protocol, marching, saluting. We had drill once a week. Mm-hmm. I think that was an hour-long course. And we had classes, probably 3 one-hour courses, like Monday, Wednesday, Friday, something like that.
Okay.
To learn the history and organization and all. There's a lot to learn about the military. Because you were born into it, so you wouldn't care.
So what about, when did you have to wear your uniform?
On those days that you had drill. You didn't wear them in for the academic classes
right.
of ROTC, but only in drill. And
okay.
that leads to one story. As executive officer, I mean, when the troops assembled for the parade on the armory floor, you had to inspect them first to make sure they had black shoes instead of brown and not white socks like I'm wearing today and so forth. And you have to be highly presentable yourself since you're the inspecting officer. And this one day, I had forgotten on the weekend to get a haircut. And so my wife at the time, didn't have any shears, any scissors except a little, tiny little cuticle scissors.
Yeah.
So she said, well, I'll do the best I can because this is Sunday evening, you see. And I had parade inspection on Monday morning, first thing. No barbershops open at that time. So she did what she could. And when I showed up, my commanding officer, the number one guy and a friend, could see me walking from the other end of the armory to the center of the parade floor. And he saw me, although I had my hat pulled down as low as I could. He said, John, what do you have, mange? He could see the big clumps and bare spots. She did the best she could.
So you got married while you were in college.
I was married in the beginning of my senior year in college.
Okay.
Yeah, and we immediately started having babies like rabbits.
So this was someone you had met in school?
In school, right,
okay.
Yeah. I had met her that spring before we married, yeah.
Okay.
And she was not a very good student. She was going to add, that's too much of a story
right.
for you. Yeah.
But you met her, you married your senior year?
Yeah, we married in my senior year, and
right.
It was her freshman year, but
okay.
she didn't want to go to school. She was expected to and didn't continue. So she was going to, once we married, she was going to support me. See, ha 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 ha. She got pregnant right away, and she got terrible morning sickness.
Uh-huh.
Couldn't hold it down. She wound up in the dispensary at school,
right?
Local school hospital, or whatever
yeah.
you want to call it. I forgot what they called
clinic.
It. Clinic. Not no. That was where she got really seriously
okay.
sick. But there was an on-campus clinic of sorts that was just to dole out pills and
right.
aspirin and band-aids and stuff like that. But then when she got really seriously sick, in fact, we had a baby down there, our first baby.
While you were still a senior?
I was on 1 week. My wife turned 21. I graduated with a bachelor's degree, commissioned a second lieutenant, and became a father all in 1 week. That was skyrockets went off that week.
So 22, you were 22 at that.
I was 22.
That's a whole lot to happen in your life.
That's right. Yeah.
So when you graduated, you said you were commissioned.
Commissioned right away, and I applied for flight training.
Okay.
So I had to wait for my flight school to open up a class,
mm-hmm.
and so I did. Blacktop paving as a laborer. I had a massive $300 debt owed to the university because it didn't make it quite. I had given up the all-expense scholarship because I thought somebody else would need that. But I did that before we married. And I didn't realize that I was going to be married that soon. I had told my wife, My life plan was that I would marry her, and I knew I loved her right from the start. But we weren't going to marry until I was 26 because I had 3 years of military, a couple of years getting established in business, and then I'd be 26. And best it didn't work plans. That way. Yeah. The juices were flowing too profusely, so we married kind of early.
Yeah.
I needn't say more.
Best laid plans.
That's right.
Yeah. So, okay, so you did blacktop paving. That's just a civilian.
Yeah,
job.
Right. And because I had to get a temporary job while the I waited for the flight class to open, which opened in October.
Okay.
And so I turned out at Lackland Air Force Base in San Antonio for orientation, and then the first flight training was at Hondo, Texas, right down the road from San Antonio.
Where did you live between college and going to flight school?
Various places. actually, we rented a place in Hinsdale, which is a house behind a house that was occupied at the time by two teachers, Hinsdale teachers, and they had gone off on a sabbatical, and they were going to be gone for all summer and then a little bit until the, so after they came back, we vacated that little house and lived with her relatives in town in Hinsdale.
So she was from the Chicago area?
She's from Hinsdale. That's why we were there.
Okay.
Anyway,
so you went down to Texas, to Lackland, Texas, you said?
Lackland for orientation and learned to deal with the troops, as it were, inductees.
How was it going down to a base as opposed to ROTC? What was the comparison? Was it a smooth transition?
Pretty smooth, yeah, because we became the officers who were inducting the recruits, the enlisted recruits.
Okay.
Some of them coming right off the bus, the train or plane or whatever. And the first thing we did was have a shakedown inspection. They had to empty their pockets. And you might have 60 people coming in for inducting into the Air Force. And from all walks of life, and some from the city, from the country, some had brass knuckles because mama said, you better take care of yourself, you know, blah, blah, blah. So how do you take care of that? Whatever. Bad things, or otherwise just goofy stuff. But they had to be inspected before allowed into the military life of the Air Force.
What happened? That was us.
Then we had to teach them how to drill, how to march, how to parade. And I'm proud of the fact that I had the champion marching group with a monkey drill, you know, whether you turn and flip the rifles around. I never carried a rifle myself.
What happened to all the contraband? Was it sent back?
Oh, no. Destroyed.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, what do you can do with brass knuckles that you just confiscated? I mean, they didn't have guns, thankfully. I didn't discover any guns.
Okay.
But I'm sure they happen from time to time.
Okay. So what were your responsibilities down there? You brought these guys in and then
trained them in marching and etiquette, military etiquette. And then by the time you got through that, and a lot of it was casual time, waiting for the class to start. And then you just packed up your gear and went to Hondo and started flight training, the academics and the hands-on flying.
What was a typical day for you like when you had this group of men under you? How many men were you responsible for?
Oh, I think it was more than a squad. I don't even remember the military organization.
Well, how, in numbers?
I'd say maybe 24 or something like that.
Okay.
Maybe a handful of squads, mm-hmm. if squads were indeed the terminology of the time.
Okay.
I kind of blacked a lot of that out.
So what was your typical day like with
them?
Your men?
Oh, that's a hard question to answer because I don't remember that.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, all I remember was the drilling of them so that they knew how to salute and how to dress, mm-hmm. how do you put your insignia on your uniform. A lot of that stuff is basic, you know, but a person off the street wouldn't know any of those basic things.
Right.
The sort of thing you learn in the military academy as a plebe,
uh-huh.
you know, and a plebe is like dirt, you know.
Right. Gotta teach you everything.
That's right.
So how long were you with these men?
Oh, that period of time at Lackland was only like 6 weeks or so. Okay. Well, as a matter of fact, we rented a house on the far corner of town. So it might have been more than 6 weeks. It might have been 3 months there before the flight class opened in Hondo, Texas. Yeah.
Okay. So had your 24 men graduated to the next level at that
point? Oh, yeah. And then we probably got another crop.
Okay.
Because their period of time was only like 6 weeks or something like that.
Okay, so you might have
And then they went off to some other training.
So you had several of those.
At least two, yeah, that I remember.
Okay. And then you went over to?
To be trained myself.
Right.
In the act of flying.
Okay. And tell me, what was your life like when you got there? Where did you live? Did you live in a house? Did you live on base?
It was a civilian contract school selling its services to the Air Force.
Okay.
It had been an Air Force training school during World War II. The barracks were abandoned and rented out to a chicken farmer. And so the barracks were chicken housing.
Okay.
And they had been cleaned up when we moved in, but not very well. So we had a little cleanup work to do. I think there was a class or two ahead of us, but you know, there's some residual. And there were bare bones housing. It wasn't Quonset huts. It was not Wherry housing either. And you're probably familiar with Wherry housing.
Yeah.
Maybe not. You were a kid then. Wherry spelled W-H-E-R-R-Y. And it was a senator or congressman who decided that the military should have decent housing and not live in dirt, you know.
Uh-huh.
And in Panama City, Florida, later, we did live in Wherry housing. And the officers' quarters were all occupied. So we were in enlisted quarters because that was available. And as it turned out, I liked it better anyhow. It was nicer stuff.
So you're in Texas right
now. Yeah, and in this these barracks-type houses that were one-family units, really. Mm-hmm. And they had almost no facility. They had hot, cold running water. And heat was by way of the oil-fired freestanding heater stoves.
Yeah.
Yeah, stoves sitting in the middle of the. And I'll remember one thing very vividly till the day I die, and that is, in Texas, they're not built for winters.
Right.
And San Antonio is pretty far south, and Hondo being at the same latitude, was not equipped. Especially these jerry-built houses were not built for winters. And so we had, the best we could afford was, you remember the shag rugs, and some of them were pretty mm-hmm. thin? Our living room was spread with a shag rug, and when a blue norther is what they called a cold front coming in, and they were cold because you're used to warmer weather,
right.
And a blue norther came in, and the cracks in the floor would levitate that shag rug a foot off the floor. I had never seen a levitating rug before that time.
So it was you and your wife, and how many kids did you have at that
point? In Hondo, I had one. She was pregnant with number two,
okay.
Which was delivered between Hondo and Laredo.
So how long were you in Hondo?
The better part of 6 months.
Okay, and that was
I don't remember.
That was your training for flight school?
That was for primary training.
Primary.
There's three levels, primary, advanced, and then I think forget what the third one is if you learn shooting and bombing and all that stuff.
So in primary, what did you learn?
I learned how to fly a Piper Cub without killing myself. Solo, you learn how to do these things in the air. Then after the Piper Cub was a T-6 Texan, which was a radial engine job. You're probably familiar with the T-6. And from the T-6 there, you graduated into the Laredo advanced flight training, which then brought us into T-28, which was a tricycle gear North American aircraft, which was great for night flying. And then from once you got through the T-28, you went into the T-33, which was a jet aircraft.
Okay.
Okay.
So you were, you said maybe 6 months?
Yeah, in each of those.
Right, okay.
And you got your wings after graduation from the jet training at Laredo. And then you got an assignment somewhere.
So you went from Hondo
to Laredo? From Laredo to Tyndall Air Force Base in Panama City, Florida.
Okay, so that was your final?
Not quite.
Okay.
It would have been my final.
Okay.
Should I get into more?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. We're kind of leapfrogging, because there was one instance I want to back up.
Okay.
Between Hondo and Laredo,
okay,
we were due to have Suzanne, our second child. But I had not been to Laredo yet, and she was imminently due to have this child. And I wasn't sure they had decent facilities down there, and would it have been delivered on the Air Force Base or in the town of Laredo? I knew that border towns are not, on either side of the border, are not very great, not very well provided. And I was madly in love with this lady, and I'm absolutely sure I'm going to take the best care of her I could. So what we did is we took leave between those two bases, brought her home and with the young child, and left them with my in-laws, her mother and her recently married second husband.
Okay.
Recently married second husband. That's vital here.
Okay.
And the point was they were going to be delivered at Great Lakes Naval Hospital, which is close by to Chicago.
Right.
Okay. And Ford, the stepfather-in-law, would then be my stepfather-in-law, would be the person to look after her during delivery and her mother and so forth. And Suzanne was delivered at Great Lakes at the grand total price of something like $4.58.
Oh, wow.
I mean, that was for telephone or something like that. But she was a bouncing baby at the time, and I got to meet her in San Antonio when the two of them, after only like 3 or 4 weeks of life on Suzanne's part, came flying down in the Constellation. And I said to her over the phone, to my wife, I said, "Don't get off the plane. I will get on the plane and help you off with the Mary and the infant, and there's dunnage to be taken care of." So
you mind, flew down with the little girl and the new baby.
And the new baby in a basket, right. And the little girl at hands. Okay. And I said, "Don't get off, because I'll come on and I'll help you off." Well, she was going to mind me, and she wasn't getting off until the stewardess said, and they were called stewardesses at the time, the stewardess said, "Lady, if you don't get off now, you're going to Mexico City, because that's where we're going next." It's American Airlines. So when I got there, I was delayed. I left the base at Laredo in plenty of time. I had already gone there and had started my training there. I had left there in plenty of time, except in that part of Texas, at least in that time, they have dry washes. You know what a dry wash is? It's a river with no water in it.
Okay.
And those dry washes were built right into the roadways of the U.S. highways, so that when the heavy rains came, they'd flood down past the road, and then the rain would be over, and it would be dry because it's going down to a river somewhere.
Right.
They need sewers everywhere, and darn if I didn't get stopped by a flood in a dry wash. It had rained hours before, and the dry wash was so full of water on the roadway that I couldn't pass until the thing drained a little bit. It delayed me about 2 hours. And so by this time, she's off the plane, and she's in the terminal trying to get a telephone call to me. She had my number at the base, at the bachelor officer's quarter where I was at the time. And she, when she left Chicago, Ford, my stepfather-in-law, said, "Do you have money?" And she's going to give her money if she, people
right.
should have money for travel. She said, "Oh yeah, I have money." Turned out she had $1 $5 bill that she's traveling to Texas with. She could not stuff that $5 bill in the phone slot.
Right.
So she was sweet-talking the operator, pleading her case that the operator had to connect her to me at the Air Force Base down in Laredo. She got the call through, went to the bachelor officer's quarter, and my classmate, Roger, answered, and he wanted to play a trick. So he says, "Oh, John, I think he's having a few drinks over at the officer's club." And about the time she's hanging up, I come behind her and put my hands over her eyes. I said, guess who? And it was me. What timing, huh? I'm a master of timing, it turned out. Anyway, the green grass grew all around after that. We got everything loaded in the car, and the family was all together, and we went down there to restart our life in the military.
And this was still down in?
In Laredo, right, okay. Laredo. And once we left from Laredo, we took leave between bases to go. We came to Chicago at a holiday, and then went to Tyndall in Panama City, Florida.
And what about what year was that?
That would have been 1956.
Okay.
It might have been the end of 55, yeah. The winter of 55, I'm through training. You get a 30-day, it wasn't 30-day, a couple of weeks leave, I think. And we went to Chicago, and then I went down to Panama City in advance. No, we went down together in the car, yeah.
Okay.
And it started life down there.
So you and her and two girls.
And two girls now.
Okay.
An infant one and a toddler.
Okay. Uh-huh. And this was another 6 months or 6 weeks?
In Panama City?
Yeah.
No, I would have been there for the rest of my 3-year hitch.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, before I got my wings at Laredo, I was given the opportunity to go to further advanced training to learn bombing and strafing and all that good stuff in the high-performance planes of the time. Mind you that the F-80 that I showed you mm-hmm. was used in Korea, but it was ineffective because it was too fast for ground support and it was too slow for aerial work because the F-86 had come on at the time.
Okay.
And that was the one that could dogfight and cope with the Russian MiGs, which were the North Koreans' armament of choice. And the Russians kept them trained and supplied. So, where am I with that story? Oh, I was given the chance to go there. But that would have meant, instead of a 3-year hitch, I would have had a 5-year hitch.
Right.
And having this growing family on my hands, with no end in sight, I thought, nope, that's not for me. I'm not going to go shooting, strafing people. That's not for me. I'll do my trick. And as turned out, I got lucky on discharge from Laredo as a new pilot to get a flying assignment. Now, Korea had wound down by then, mm-hmm. and they didn't need a lot of pilots. So they had very few flying assignments given out to these brand new pilots. And I was lucky to have a flying assignment at Panama City. Other guys had a quartermaster assignments or administrative duties elsewhere around the country. And because they didn't choose to go on to fly warplanes.
Right.
It turns out that the T-33 is a warplane. It's a converted warplane. It's stretched body. And at that time, I've got some history of it there for you if you want it. It was first manufactured in 1944 as a prototype, but was in active duty not until 1948 or something like that. 48 was it was converted, re-engineered, let's say.
Okay.
All they did was stretch the body, put an extra cockpit in there, but left all the nose section with gun mounts and everything else. So they had to have balance on the plane. And that's what I was flying. It had all the switches and the tip tanks, and you could drop bombs with all these switches and stuff, but there were no bombs to drop.
Right.
So
what were you doing with it?
The mission pilot job, they called it AFSC, Air Force Specialty Code. In the Air Army, they would have been called it MOS, military.
Right.
Okay. And especially with mission pilot. So what do I do down there? Oh, surprise, surprise. I got to fly every day, every blessed day, I got to fly that T-33. And I racked up close to 900 hours in about a year.
And what was the flying?
And the flying for was this. Now, mind you, at that time, the federal government thought that the Russians were going to fly over here and drop bombs with their intercontinental bombers, military bombers. And the later on, that was, that whole idea was displaced by the silo missiles that were going to be mass destruction. And no, we hate mass destruction now, but we were building our own mass destruction, and we doubled the force that Russians had, and we were aiming at each other and all that kind of stuff. But at this time, they built the place where you were born in Michigan, I mean in Alaska, the distant early warning system with with all these radar sites. Well, somebody had to man those radar sites to see what those blips were all about. Is this an Eskimo out there just flying his prop plane, or is it a military plane coming across the pole to bomb Chicago? Well, your father had to figure that out, because he was in that radar business. And we had to train people like your father by actually having airplanes in the air. And I was one of those airplanes. And we would fly missions of intercept. Here comes a bogey, being an enemy, coming on a track. And some of us would fly bogey missions. Some of us would fly interceptor missions. We'd fly two aircraft in a flight, first to identify, is this a friend or a foe? And a second to shoot it down. This is all pretend. It's all war game.
Right.
But it's in the training mission, because although they had, for training the radar operators, they had some early primitive computer simulations. There's no computer simulation that can give you the actual hands-on stuff with body in the air.
Right.
So we were the bodies in the air for the advanced level of the radar trainees.
Okay.
And that's what my mission was.
Okay.
Now, the next issue of the story
comes
like this, and it happens in Panama City. Endemic there was both polio and meningitis, which flourished from time to time. And it just turned out that one day I was sick, and I ran a fever that ran up to about 102.5 or 103, and went into the sick bay. The flight surgeon looked after me, and the thing diminished, and I'm well under 103, maybe 101 by now, and they send me home. And when I get home, my wife is sick. She became sick to the point where she didn't come out of the hospital for 23 days, and she was paralyzed at that point. And we had two children at home. And there were promises made in the military we will look after dependents, first class treatment. Well, the first class rehab person that worked with her was a guy who had two stripes on his shoulders, which would be airman second class or something like that, or first, whatever the airman's ranks were. And he had had about 6 weeks training, and the apparatus he had was a plywood wheel on the wall, but anchored by a stove bolt into a 2x4 and a handle on the thing. And lady, here, you crank it this way for a while and then crank it. She couldn't even reach that high. She had an upside down polio. It was from the waist up instead of the waist down.
So it was polio.
Polio later on. We couldn't figure that out down there.
Uh-huh.
They had done all the proper tests, the spinal taps, and it was aseptic. At that point, they diagnosed it as aseptic spinal meningitis with encephalitis.
Okay.
Serious problem. And they were going to send her their remedy, because they couldn't deal with that issue in Panama City. They would send her to Montgomery, Alabama, where the nearest decent military hospital. What am I going to do with two kids here and a wife up there? So I took an emergency leave, like a weekend pass, and brought the whole family up to Chicago, flew them up, and deposited them with my in-laws, who looked after them for a while until we got settled into a protocol for treating Carol's illness. We got the best people in the business in Chicago, and they re-diagnosed it as polio, and checked her into outpatient clinic at Rehabilitation Institute of Chicago, which today is the number one rehab facility in the country, if not the world.
Right.
And so she spent months and months coming out of that. In the meantime, I applied to the chain of command at the base to get a compassionate transfer to someplace near Chicago so I could continue to look after my family. And I went to my CO, and then he went to the base commander, and the base commander says, no, I can't do that because the person who's holding sway is the flight surgeon, and he's in charge of the be-all and end-all of pilots.
Right.
And so the flight surgeon was a not a gruff person, but he's not the guy that looked after me day to day, but the guy that was top of the heap. He was a physician, of course, because being a flight surgeon, but I couldn't feature that a really dedicated physician would want to be in the military, especially in the Air Force. And he was one of those bureaucratic types. And he said words to the effect, well, this is the Army, Mr. Jones, you know, no private baths or telephones and, you know, blah, blah, blah. Gritted out because I had like another year to go down there. So after counseling with my fellow officers, I wrote to my senator, Paul Douglas at the time. And I told him the situation in brief, probably more brief than I'm telling you, because I didn't lay any blame on anybody. It was just a situation I found myself in. And even though I couldn't get a transfer from the chain of command, Paul Douglas wrote me a telegram every day for 5 days, and on the fifth day, his orders were cut to transfer me to O'Hare.
Oh, wonderful.
Now, in
That's
O'Hare.
About as close as you could get.
That's right. That's about as close as I could get. And what was at O'Hare? There were two facilities there. One was F-86D Air Defense Command with the bullet-nosed F-86s, and I thought, oh, my, won't I be lucky to get to fly those? And, no, that wasn't going to happen. I became a permanent personnel of the reserve crew there, and they had a reserve air refueling, paratroop group, 2571st or something. I forget the number, parachute squadron. And they were just the carriers of the troops. You know, the Air Force ran the planes, and the Army ran the personnel. And so I got to fly those wonderful machines called C-46, C-47, and C-119. That was like driving your garage around town.
Those had those big ones.
Right? Yeah, really big. I mean, if you want to get the feeling of it, try flying this room. Yeah. You're in the cockpit. they were about as streamlined as the room, too.
And what was the purpose of the flights?
The purpose of the flights was just to keep the reservists as sharp as you could on a once-a-month basis. They had once a month. In the meantime, I did personnel-type things. In fact, while there, the 6 months reserve program was started, and I became the presenter in assemblies to seniors at high school. So at places like Senn High School in Northwest Chicago, I would go to their assembly and then tell them what the 6 month program was all about. You have 6 months active duty and 8 years reserve total and blah, blah, blah. And we filled the program in about 2 months. They got as many people as they needed because, you know, who wouldn't go for 6 months instead of 2 years or 3 years?
Right.
And so that was an interesting time. And one little vignette I might mention, while on that, I was aerodrome officer from time to time. Now, that was, somebody had to be on the base at the off hours when the full complement of people were not there. And one guy in charge of flying missions to make sure the logs were, you know, and the aircraft was assigned and everything was protocol proper. And so I'd have that duty a couple of times. One time when I was aerodrome officer, Chicago was hosting the, not the Blue Angels, the Air Force, Thunderbirds. Mm-hmm. It might have been a Blue Angel. No, it was Thunderbirds.
Okay.
Because it was Air Force needs. So they had done their thing on the lakefront, done their, you know, their flying show. And then they came back and it overnighted somewhere, probably a fancy motel nearby to O'Hare, but there were no fancy motels there.
Right.
But someplace. They took care of themselves, no doubt. And I had to look after their logistics, you know. Those aircraft that they flew were now flying not gaseous oxygen, but LOX, liquid oxygen. And they had smaller tanks, less weight, and liquid. Now, where do you get refills on LOX in O'Hare? They didn't even have jet commercial airlines yet. Right. So that, and I don't know if today if jet airlines use LOX or not. But where do I find it? Well, I got on the phone and I started calling people like Air Reduction Company and Lindy Air and so forth, the people who were in the oxygen reduction business.
Right.
And it turned out that any one of them could bring the stuff out, but they didn't have liquid oxygen because that's not used in hospitals and other places.
Mm-hmm.
Only gaseous oxygen is
right.
used. Or maybe now it is, but at that time it wasn't. And so what happened was we had to get a troop carrier aircraft bringing a trailer with a tank from Fort Campbell, Kentucky to O'Hare to refuel the oxygen port of that one aircraft that was low on oxygen. And he couldn't take off for someplace else, you know, to go home to
right.
Arizona or wherever without his oxygen tank being full.
Right.
Because you just don't go on half a tank, you know,
right.
or even a little bit of a tank. So that took a couple of days to transact, but it was an interesting time in my Air Force career.
So you said when you were in Florida and your wife got sick and came back, you had a year left.
Yes.
So you were up in
O'Hare.
In Chicago,
right.
in O'Hare.
And I rented an apartment in Chicago, and I commuted from near Northside, where she was close enough to Rehab Institute, and
right.
she could commute daily, sometimes in taxi. Most of the time, she'd take a bus and get there because as time went by, she got stronger and stronger through
right.
her rehabilitation and the reconstruction of her own body.
Right. Okay. So how long were you at O'Hare? Did you just finish out the year? Did you spend more time?
Yeah, it was from somewhere in the winter of 56, and I was discharged in September 57.
Okay.
Right.
Okay. So.
Discharged from active duty, not from the reserve.
So
I wasn't taken out of the reserve status, inactive reserve, until I think it was 1970.
Really?
I don't know why they kept me on. Maybe I was such super good stuff. I don't know. I want to believe that anyway.
So what did being in the, you said the inactive reserves?
Right. And they would just send me an illustration every once in a while. And surprise, surprise, somewhere in the, I think it was in the middle or late 60s, I was promoted to captain in inactive reserve. I had been second Louis, first Louis, while in active duty.
Right.
And in fact, I was made, while at Panama City, I was had enough hours and evidently good marks, I don't know what those were,
right.
that they made me an instructor pilot. And one issue, this is an interesting thing, I'll tell,
okay.
it's kind of out of time sequence, but back at Panama City, I'm now a instructor pilot. And what does an instructor pilot do? Well, he gives check rides to, annual check rides are required
mm-hmm.
for a pilot to make sure he is still proficient. He hasn't learned any bad habits or forgotten things that need to be done. And the commanding officer of my unit had been transferred or retired or something like that. And a new guy came in, a major.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember his name and it doesn't matter. But this major was a what I call a retread. He was from World War II
mm-hmm.
and he was a pilot who had had a lot of missions in whatever. It was mostly in multi-engine flying. And he'd had a desk job in Washington or someplace. And then he was reactivated and sent down there to be commander of this group of young jet jockeys, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But he really needed to fly jets himself to become still qualified to fly. Now, this guy had the rank of command pilot. Now, do you remember what that's all about? A mere pilot has silver wings.
Right.
Navy has gold wings. Ours are made of tin, if you listen to the way they sing it. Air Force wings are made of tin. Navy wings are made of gold, blah, 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 blah. Anyway, his wings had a star above the shield, that's a senior pilot, and a wreath around the star is a command pilot. And you don't get a command pilot rating until something like 3,000 hours in the air or something, a lot of hours, I don't know what it is, a lot of hours. Anyway, I looked at his wings and I said, I'm going to give him a check ride today.
See? Right.
I look at his wings. I say, by golly, I bet you he's been in the air longer than I've been alive.
Yeah.
But I told him what I wanted him to do. I said, you're going to go under the hood and identify the, I want you to go from here, from Panama City to Tallahassee and Tallahassee to Dothan, Alabama, or vice versa. I forget what. I do remember this. The identifier code at Tallahassee is TLH.
Right.
And the identifier code at Dothan is DHN. They both have an H in them.
Right.
And you had to identify them by the Morse code in those years.
Okay.
We had very primitive radio equipment. You know, although this was a 500-mile-an-hour jet aircraft, it had the early ones had crank radios with it. I mean, they were from 1942 or so.
Mm-hmm.
But they have somehow fitted those planes up. After all, you could put anything in a training plane, right?
Right.
I mean, that's the rationale, I presume. And so he went under the hood, and he did a nice job of flying, and he started settling on the radio direction found, and he got over to what he thought was going to be Tallahassee. Well, it turned out to be Dothan, Alabama radio that he had tuned in on, not being aware that there are two different directions on
right.
the compass, but the identifier with the H evidently was a little bit jangled, and you can be that way. So I let him go all the way down to, as if you're coming through the clouds now, to the minimum descent height. And I said, okay, pop the hood. And he looked around, there's nothing but forest and swamp. he had done his letdown on the wrong radio station. And I said to him, I said, well, technically this is a flunk, but I'm not going to flunk you. I'm going to give you a pass on the premise that you, with a command pilot rating, are smart enough that, I didn't say it in these words, I'm paraphrasing now for my own grandizement, and that you will promise that you'll take at least three instructional rides in the next week, and then take a check again just for your own purposes
right.
after that time. And he swore that he would do that. I never ran across him again. I mean, he was at least two steps, maybe three steps above me in rank anyhow.
Right. So then that was down in Florida.
In Florida, yeah.
Okay. So you came back from Florida with your wife and your two kids.
Uh-huh.
You were in the apartment in Chicago. You're working at O'Hare.
By the way, we had planted a third kid that was born on Christmas 1957. A few months after I was out of active duty.
Okay. So you were still in Chicago.
Yeah,
you're out of active,
right.
But you're in inactive reserves.
Right, from then on.
How did they figure out how long you were to be in active reserves? How long in
I have no
reserves
idea.
At all?
Well, I had an inkling that the total reserve commitment after commissioning was going to be 8 years.
Okay.
But it turned out to be more than that. It turned out to be like 13, because I was given my discharge, I think 1970. Let me see here. I have notes. Yeah, 4 March 1970 is what my discharge paper says.
Okay.
So from 57 to 70 is 13 years.
And you had no responsibilities to
no.
show up or
no, I didn't have to.
Or?
I don't think I had to even reply to anything. That about once a year they'd send you what you know what military orders look like.
Uh-huh.
And you know, there's multiple lines and you happen to be on this line on that page and they send you the page and so you figure that out. Oh, yeah, that's me. Okay.
Okay.
They don't want anything from me today.
Okay. So during that time, what business did you go into?
Oh, now that takes me to my career. I said early on that I had applied to three airlines.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time I got back from them, word back, I decided that this is not the time to be at the low man on the totem pole in airlines, earning the least amount of money that an airline pilot could, and they weren't making a great deal then.
But you said the World War II pilots were.
Yeah, because the market was flooded with World War II pilots looking for a flying job. Because, you know, it's pretty cushy. Mm-hmm. You don't fly every day. You know, there was limits on FAA requirements even today, and there was then. But these guys, some of them stayed on. And later on, after I had my kids mostly grown, I bought an airplane. I couldn't afford one before that, but I bought an airplane. And I ran across a number of these guys that I was avoiding getting involved with in the 50s. And they were World War II pilots, went to work for United or American. And I flew out here at Brookridge. I had a spot to place out to park my plane out there. And I had a plane for about 6 years, and I found that it's a lonesome pastime. My wife liked to go as long as we were going someplace, but it turned out she didn't like the attitude adjustment of the airplane. She said, "Do you have to swoop when you land?" I said, "What's swooping?" I said, "You have to bank the plane. You can't slide it sideways." And, you know, so I knew she was uncomfortable, but she never let on about that until I was about ready to get rid of the plane anyway. She said, I never did get that much about it. It was a bore to her.
Yeah. So you started your career. You started with, did you go right into this food industry?
Yeah, that's when I decided against that airline stuff. I was also applying. This was the summer of 57. I was going to impending discharge, and I wrote to a few food companies. One was Food Machinery in downstate Illinois. They're internationally known people with harvesting equipment and food you know, pea viners and all that kind of stuff. And Hoops in Illinois, yeah. And Foremost Foods in California. Mm-hmm. And they were recommended to me by one of my professors at University of Illinois as having had a couple of alums there and their international service doing reconstituted milk plants in Japan and the Far East, places, maybe island nations out there. And on that basis, I thought, oh man, Foremost Foods is a pretty good place to work. It turned out it wasn't, because when I decided to have an interview there, I was in touch with a vice president at Foremost, and he said, "Yeah, you come out here and we'll talk and we'll see what we can do with one another." So at my expense, I got a military plane to take me to Denver. Mm-hmm. Yeah, to Denver. Then I went commercial from Denver to San Francisco, and on their Battery Street headquarters, I showed up and they didn't know who I was. I have an appointment with your vice president, so-and-so. Oh, he's out of town. Well, we'll get somebody to interview you. And after long, all was said and done, the guy said, "Well, maybe we could get you on as an operator of a bottle washer in North Dakota at our plant up there, and maybe at about $325 a month." Well, I had been earning $750 in the military.
Right.
And it turned out that the company I chose was a perfect match for me, and mm-hmm. I stayed with them for 30 years. And but they're in the machinery business, as I mentioned right. earlier, and it was all mechanical. There were problems to be solved with each application in each place, even though some of them were similar or even identical. There were different people and different circumstances in the market, and so it was a wonderful choice for me because it had both the chemical scientific part of my training mm-hmm. and the mechanical aptitude that I showed early on,
right.
continuing to this day. I'm always trying to fix things. I will not tolerate anything not working in my household or in your household if I'm at your house. If you have a bum screen door, I'm going to fix that before I leave. Anyway, that was a good fit. In fact, so good a fit that when I retired early at age 55, I went into consulting business in that same industry, mm-hmm. and much of my work was done for that same company.
Okay.
At greatly inflated prices.
Yes.
And then I, one of the assignments I went, we became, after a number of mergers, we became a part of an English-owned company, mm-hmm. which was our worldwide competitor at the time. And they sent me to, as a consultant, as a hiring, to run the office in Hong Kong. And I was there for 3 years. I took my wife along with, by then my kids were all grown and
right.
gone. And it was a wonderful experience. Some of the best decisions I ever made were along the trail that I just described for you.
Okay.
Yeah.
It sounds like you did more traveling as a civilian than you did in the military.
I did. Yes, I did. Yeah. Yeah. It was my primary work was in a training context here for the first couple of years because I was very youthful looking. In fact, mm-hmm. I'm sure you would not guess that I'm 81 mm-hmm. by looking at me because nobody does. They usually guess me 10 or 15 years younger. Mm-hmm. But it's one of those genetic things. Hair, lucky yeah. hair, lucky hair and lucky face and oily skin. Anyway, where's it going with that thread?
That you were doing some training.
Oh, yeah, yeah. My first job there was just to get accustomed to the industry and what the company makes mm-hmm. and how and why and to, for whom they make it. And so I would be doing a lot of time on a drafting board, laying out plant for reconstruction or for conveyorization, and it turned out that we were in the business of mechanizing and robotizing a lot of that stuff. We were early on in the computer business, and we even built our own computers because the PC hadn't been invented yet.
Right.
And you know, our own computer for the company was a room about this size, maybe 12 by 20 or something like that, full of computers secondhand from North Central Airlines. They were upgrading,
okay.
so they sold us their computer, and we had an air conditioned room, and yeah, you know the story. You were with you work with IBM, you know what I'm talking about.
I remember those computers.
Yeah, we started with punch cards.
Yeah, I remember those too.
Yeah. And anyway, the punch cards went the way of American Indian, I guess.
So, in your civilian life, did you still keep in touch with anybody you met in the Air Force?
One guy.
Okay.
One guy. I should mention another, though. A fellow was in our flight class at Hondo. No. This is at Laredo. He had already gone through jet training. And you had an option to go on to advanced and learn fighter bomber or
right.
aircraft or high-performance aircraft, or helicopter school. He chose to go to helicopter school. And he became the traffic copter in New York City. And he was there for many years. And I one time was sent a one of my colleagues in New York, I was sent a cartoon of this guy in a helicopter, you know. He was the local guy, just like
yeah.
we had a local guy here. And unfortunately, after a dozen or more years of doing that, he had crashed and he had killed himself. I never did. To this day, I don't trust helicopters.
So, and you said there's one other guy you keep in touch
with?
Oh,
this other guy was my seatmate at primary school and advanced school,
okay.
both at Hondo, Texas, and at Laredo. And he actually coaxed me into going to single-engine jet school instead of multi-engines and becoming a bomber pilot, staying with SAC and living in the air for days on end. And when we were choosing which way to go in Hondo, and we had a few days to make up our mind. And I would come to the flight line table. We had a table like this, and four guys on each side and the instructor on the end. And it would, assignment for the day. And I would come walking in from wherever my wife and I and kid child were living, and he'd come walking in, and he'd come looking at me, and he would rotate two propellers in the sky with his hands, and he'd go, kind of coaxing me to live my life of security in the air with propellers, By golly, he irritated me to the point that I went to single engine jets with him down El Dorado. And to this day, he lived a whole different life. He didn't do anything in flying afterwards either, but he lives in Central America now after he had a very nice, successful career here. Okay. Originally from Boston. And the reason we became so close is at Hondo, the officers club, you know, a pretend officers club like it would be in a real base, because right. It was a dry county there, and yet the only way you could have anything to drink is if you had a club and you had your own bottle at right. the bar. He looked so much alike to me as the bartender there thought it was me, and he was a bachelor. I was married. I wasn't out drinking all the time. I had the answer to my wife, you know. So I had a bottle there so that we could have a drink from time to time. But he had a bottle that he was drinking out of all the time. And one day I came and I thought I had 3/4 of a bottle left. And it was almost gone. I said, well, what happened? I asked the bartender. And he said, you were just here. You came back. No, that wasn't me that was just here. It was Paul. It was my buddy Paul was drinking out of my bottle. He didn't know it. The bartender mistook him for me. We were that similar in appearance. Uh-huh. And then it's funny how those things come together. At times we would welcome him into our household because he was a bachelor throughout his military. And in Panama City, he would come over in the morning sometime and have breakfast with us. And he'd bring groceries maybe because he'd feel guilty about eating our groceries
right.
and he'd bring eggs and bread and whatever, you know, he'd go to the commissary and bring stuff to us. We were that close.
So, and you said you haven't joined any veterans organizations.
No, I didn't take a veterans loan for a house or didn't, the GI Bill was useless to me because I had already had my education
right.
when I got in. And the one thing that you see these things in my ears?
You
hearing me? A year ago, I convinced the bureaucracy of the Veterans Administration at Hines that I was qualified by virtue of all of those little situations. I mean, I could afford to buy them, but I'll be darned if I wanted to get something out of the government. So I got 2 hearing aids from the VA.
Okay.
Yeah, but it was at great expense of my own time because
yes.
you don't do things like that easily over there.
Mm-hmm.
You have to go through all the protocols and appointment after appointment. You can't do things all in one day. No way. You got to have everybody's has jobs over there. The catchword is jobs.
Right.
No matter whether they're important or not, they make you feel important. The thing that gets me, oh, we really, all the bureaucratic messages that come from Washington or wherever the VA lives say, we really appreciate all the service you've performed for your country. Some of this wrapping of the flag around people, it just makes me sick. And I mean, I did my job and I feel I was a contributor to the effect. Mm-hmm. And if the war were raging at the time, it wasn't. It was the Cold War between right. Korea and Vietnam, and I don't think people in government even knew how to spell Vietnam when I was in there.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, when I was established in civilian life, oh, here comes another war. Isn't that nice? We'll right. send a few troops over there. Ha, ha, ha. So a few troops and some Agent Orange and some mass bombing and all that stuff, and it makes me sick.
Mm-hmm.
And we keep still doing it. We're the world's bullies.
So how did your service affect the way you view what's happening in the world?
Well, it confirms my opinion that we are doing a terrible job as citizens of the world.
Mm-hmm.
We think we're doing well for everybody because we want to spread democracy around. We're teaching democracy to people who don't even understand the concept. And they probably are better under a totalitarian government than they are under ours. Now, that's heresy for me to say that. But I do believe that. We have no business getting into other people's lives.
Mm-hmm.
It's not our mission on earth. I don't think God put us here to spread democracy. We're here to look after one another, mm-hmm. not beat each other up.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Is there anything we haven't talked about that you'd like to add before we finish?
No, let me take a look at my notes.
Okay.
Yeah, I've mentioned Oh, yeah, the little. You run across little vignettes from time to time. While in flight training with the T-33, one of the things we were taught was if you're gonna come down with one gear not locked down, bring them all up and land on your belly.
Okay.
But in doing that, have the dive brake up too, so that you land smoothly on the flush fuselage. This one student was up and he had one gear wouldn't come down, or it wouldn't lock down. It's probably down, but he didn't know it was locked. So instead of, he brought the gear up, but he left the dive brake down. It's a big plate. And he landed so beautifully while I'm watching, I'm standing on the tarmac. He grind down that plate to where it was about one third of its length. And there was almost nothing, no damage to that plane, except the dive brake and a little bit of scratching on the tail end of the housing around the engine. And I mean, it was a beautiful job. And I watched all these sparks fly as he came to a stop. Now, the reason they have the dive brake up is it could be that it would cartwheel you over if it tripped you. You know, it's like tripping on a curb on foot. And so, but he did it, and he knew exactly what to do, and I thought it was a wonderful job. But he probably got reprimanded for that, even though he came home alive,
He tried,
safe,
yeah.
and the plane was in as good a condition as it could have been. Yeah. And there was another situation where one of the oh, the guy that gave the bum steer to my wife on the telephone, he was the son. He had a Hispanic name, and I could dig it out if you're interested, but what's the point? His father was a general in the Air Force. And Roger smashed two aircraft in different occasions. He
Two Air
graduated,
Force
two
aircraft.
Air Force aircraft. And usually, in a situation like that, you smash one plane and you're out of flight training. You're gone. You know, you're disqualified. But he went on to get his wings, and he had, I don't know if he had a flying assignment or not, but it illustrated to me that it's not exactly what you know, it's who you know. And these people with pull in all walks of life, whether it's Chicago politics or the federal government or the military, that has given me a lifelong attitude that it's who you
Who
know,
you know?
right? And there's more to that story.
Okay.
Carol's polio, we talked about that. Compassionate transfer. Paul Douglas. Flying different things. Oh, I told you about the air show. Benefits, right. I think I've covered it pretty well.
Do you think the military, your military experience had a positive influence on your
Oh
life?
yes, oh yes, it was
In what
it
way?
was a growing experience, and I, as a matter of fact, when I was, even while I was in and long after I was out of the military, I felt that it was imperative that the United States have universal military training for girls and boys alike. It worked in Russia, it worked in Israel, it worked everywhere. Switzerland, they have had, at least they did at the time I was in Switzerland. And it's a growing experience, and the government could not spend money in a better way than to keep people at a lot. Well, some advantaged people go to college, go to a fraternity, sorority, or whatever, and these are transitional experiences from home. I did it my way because I was married right away. I mean, I really wasn't living alone until my wife died 7 years ago. You know, I mean, it was all that time. It was my mother's household, then my wife's household, and now I'm single. So, but I'm living the experience in my 70s and 80s that I might have lived in, experienced in my 20s. And I thought that military training was would be the right way than to have the hierarchical structure of the reserves doing almost nothing throughout their reserve career and the active duty people in a skeleton force. I didn't think that was a very effective way to deal with it. And it turns out it wasn't. Now we have mostly reservists going off to these bogus wars that we have
Mm-hmm.
Iraq and Afghanistan and everywhere. And I don't think the reservists deserve that. On the other hand, hey, if you're getting money for being in the reserve, then you should serve your country. I mean, I did for the money I got for that period of time when they paid me. And if they wanted me to go someplace, oh, one experience, yeah, here. Those were war games going on during the Cold War.
Right.
There was one that was contrived by, it's contrived is not the right word to use, that's a negative word. But that was initiated to be prepared for all services to be prepared for a possible invasion, either by submarine, by water, you know, from the Atlantic or from the Gulf or from the air over the poles. And all of the military was marshaled into a war game, whatever it was called. I forget, it had a name. And I happened to be in Panama City, and I was on duty because most everybody was given leave for the holiday. And I was on duty as a pilot at the ready to do whatever was required. Well, they had a early warning, although it was down in south, it was simulated radar, which was part of the war games. They had to find people that were coming by air from the Gulf. Maybe they were carriers out in the Gulf or out in the Atlantic. And so this thing had to be operational. Everything had to be frontline operational during this period of time of about a week in war games. And the generator in that antenna, that rotating antenna for the radar, went bad. So they put a new set of brushes off the shelf onto the generator, and everything was working, just, you know, doing what it's supposed to do, but they didn't have one on the shelf. So Jacus, you go to Rome, New York, and get a spare generator brush so that we're fully backed up. You got to be back up, right? This is all solid thinking. So I dutifully got in the T-33 and headed for Rome, New York. I couldn't make it all in one flight, so I had to stop at Patuxent Naval Air Station for refueling. And between me and Patuxent was a line of thunderstorms that went to all the way up, it's nighttime, all the way up to 43,000 feet. Now that aircraft would make it at 41. Fortunately, I'd burned off enough fuel. I could just wallow through the tops of the thunderstorms, and I got through that line of thunderstorms and landed at Patuxent, overnighted there. I went immediately to Rome, New York after refueling, and then overnighted at Rome, New York, having the brush in hand, whatever it was, a package. And I went back to Panama City, Florida with it. And that was my mission for the war games, to keep the radar antenna going.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this was overall a really good experience for you. You felt like you grew.
Oh, it was a very good growing experience that I couldn't have bought any other way. There's no way in civilian life I could have bought that. And so that has something to say for it. I'm not against military. I'm against war.
Right.
The military can do a lot of things that they do during disasters now without going to war. I'm just very anti-war. I would have done my part had I been equipped with bombs, but I'm glad I didn't. I never had to shoot anybody, strafe anybody, drop any bomb, and I'm glad of that.
Right. Okay. Is there anything else before
we
go off record?
I think that would be a good place to stop.
Then we're going off record.